Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Urban Studies. I'm Peter Christian Eigner, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Steve Kahn about his new book, Americans Against the City, Anti-Urbanism in the 20th Century. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it was a great book. It was a pleasure reading it, and I'm very glad that you could join us today. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the project?
Sure. I'm a professor in the history department at Ohio State, and I was really trained to be an intellectual historian, a historian of ideas. But I also, along the way, have picked up a real interest in the history of cities. I teach now urban history courses and a history more broadly of what historians like to call the built environment. And so where this book comes from is an attempt to try to put those two broad interests together. So what I'm trying to do in this book is look at the history of an idea, that is to say, the anti-urban tradition in American life, and look at the way it shaped real places, places that people live and work and imagined American society could move into from the late 19th century, really, you know, pretty close to the present day. Book took a long time. A lot of things got in the way, and there were a number of fits and starts. But that's where the book came from.
That's interesting. Why don't we get right to it? I said this to you before we began the interview, but I'm sort of astounded that there isn't a survey like this. It's long overdue, and it's very well done. You begin the book by talking about the American urban paradox. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, so if you want to go way back to the founding of the nation, you know, Jefferson stands as that embodiment of all of the anti-urban ideals in this country. We were going to be a nation of yeoman farmers, and that was going to guarantee independence and virtue, and that was going to make the American experiment survive. But in fact, of course, from the end of the 18th century right up to the present day, the population of the United States has continued to urbanize, and nowadays we talk about it more in terms of metropolitan areas rather than, strictly speaking, cities. So even as we pay homage to all of those ideals that Jefferson articulated, that we want our 40 acres out there, we want a home on the range, et cetera, et cetera, we've actually been moving more and more to cities. It's something nowadays like 75% of us live in metropolitan regions of 200,000 or more. So, you know, in 1790, there were about 5% of us that lived in cities, and now virtually nobody lives out in the country or in a small town or anything like that. That's the paradox, is that we are a metropolitan nation filled with people who are still pretty suspicious of urban life.
Yeah, I love that you begin the story with Jefferson and talking about the founding, because it, you know, it points up a fact that I think is hugely important that I try to emphasize in my work too, that, you know, is sort of lost as you move further away from the late 1700s, which is that, you know, we labor under that constitutional system, and that constitutional system was designed by people who were very anti-majoritarian, and, you know, you use this phrase, it's the tyranny of the small town, when you consider that up until Baker v. Carr, you know, it's really a minority of the country that was controlling policy. And so when you study American social and political development, you always have to sort of keep in mind that it's not, you know, including this period that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the anti-urban tradition functions at the level of cultural myths, right? Marlboro Man and cowboys and all of that stuff. But it is also, as you point out, built in structurally from the very beginning in the federal constitution and then in any number of state constitutions as well, that representation is disproportionately given to the rural areas at the expense of, again, across the 200 years, growing urban centers. So yeah, they have always, and you see this play out, I think, in all kinds of states in particular, that Springfield, Illinois is constantly trying to figure out ways to stick it to Chicago, and Albany is trying to stick it to New York City, and Harrisburg to Philadelphia, and so on and so forth, that the way in which those anti-urban politics play out at the state level can be pretty bitter and has been for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And they control, these cities do not have a home rule,
That's
I mean
right.
that
Yeah. And
so they.
I came across, and again, historians of the progressive era will know this, but one of the great progressive historians, a guy named Frederick Ward Howe, put out a book, and it must have been just about 100 years ago, actually, about 1913. And that's exactly what he called for. He called for the creation of what would amount to these city-states, that the cities were going to be the future of American life, and therefore we had to rebuild the structures of our politics to acknowledge that they were the economic centers, the population centers, the intellectual centers, the cultural centers. But our politics didn't reflect that. So that's 100 years ago he's making the observation.
Well, I know that Benjamin Barber has been going around with a book that's arguing the same thing. It really is sort of backwards when you think about the way that the system is run. So you begin talking about Jefferson, and then you sort of go through in the first chapter a sort of sad litany
The greatest hits tour.
Maybe you could talk a little bit
Sure.
about some of those
Well,
characters.
yeah, there are other nations that have a nostalgic romantic relationship with the rural, with the pastoral, and so forth. We inherited this to some extent from the English, but what's striking about the American tradition is just how many of our leading figures, our leading intellectual figures, especially in the 19th century, are so aggressively anti-urban. And so start with Jefferson, move your way through to the Transcendentalists, who thought salvation was to be had, as a transparent eyeball in the woods, Thoreau, and all. And so you march through, and what's rare in American life are those intellectual figures who really want to celebrate the values of urbanity, to celebrate the possibilities of urbanism. So, the famous line of Samuel Johnson's about he who tires of London tires of life, from the 17th century. There's no American really who's going to articulate the same kind of sensibility. That's what's really striking in the 19th century.
Yeah, I kept on waiting for you to bring somebody in, and thinking to myself, I mean, surely there's some great intellectual defender of cities in American life and in American history. And
Well, I think I probably could have highlighted a couple of them a little more. In the 20th century, Jane Addams, I think, stands as one of those figures. In the early 20th century, maybe William White, the journalist, in the mid 20th century, as well. And more recently, I mean, I think part of what drove me to write this book in the first place is that we're living in a moment right now where at least some number of people are kind of rediscovering the city. And some cities have become quite, fashionable or trendy or whatever it is that you want to call it. So I think maybe in this generation, there are writers who are going to emerge. But when you put them up against Jefferson and Emerson, it's a kind of unfair comparison.
It seems very lopsided, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe this is a good time to point out that we're using some terms here that you go to some pains to explain in the beginning. So, I mean, when we're talking about the anti-urban, we're not just talking about a physical place. We're also talking about a set of ideals, right?
Yep, that's right.
I mean, you have that nice quote from Aristotle in the beginning that a great city is not to be conflated with or confused with population.
That's right. So what cities represent is and I try to sketch this out very, very quickly. I see the function of cities in two broad senses, marketplace and meeting place. So cities, reach back 8,000 years. Cities begin to form because of an economic function, right? That they become as agriculture develops and trading and all this sort of cities become the place of economic exchange. But simultaneously, right, that people discover that bringing people together in those concentrations, now you're out of your tribe, you're out of your little hunting and gathering band, all kinds of other things begin to happen, intellectual and cultural frictions, and the things that bubble out because of that, the exchange of ideas. And this is very basic to the development of human civilization, right? It's not a coincidence that the word city and the word civilization have the same Greek root.
No.
So that marketplace and that meeting place is the way I, broadly speaking, and it's a very generalized definition, but that's the way I was thinking about the role of cities. And I think in the United States that remains true, and certainly was true across the 20th century. The anti-urban tradition, in contrast, as I describe it, is also in two parts. On the one hand, it's a kind of ethno-racial paranoia. American cities in particular, more so than European cities, become places of tremendous heterogeneity. Starts in Philadelphia, right, in the 18th century when it's attracting all of these different people, but certainly by the turn of the 20th century, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Chicago, just become these extraordinarily polyglot, mixed up populations of people. And there are lots of Americans who simply recoil at all of this. In the 19th century, it's heavily religiously inflected. It's Catholics. We don't like them. It's Jews. We don't like them even more. But I think more broadly, it is this kind of ethno-racial hostility that make people recoil from the city. By the early part of the 20th century, these cities have grown so big so fast that if you're going to make life livable in these cities, you have to exercise the mechanisms of government. The private economy has failed, in a sense, by the end of the 19th century to keep up with the demands that these cities are making. Water, lighting, sanitation, all those kinds of basic things that we need to survive, the market, as it were, the 19th century economy is not delivering. So if you're going to make life livable in these cities, you've got to use the tools of government. And that's what the progressives really understood at the beginning of the 20th century. So lots of Americans as well hate the idea that the city represents government intervention. And probably even more, government intervention that works, right? The idea that in New York City now, 8 million people can turn on their tap and get drinkable water. I mean, that's a miracle.
Yeah.
Efficiencies that government manages to deliver in cities becomes anathema to this kind of anti-government tradition, which I see as part and parcel of the anti-urban tradition.
Yeah. Well, and you note that I mean, this is problem solving on a huge scale. I mean, the statistics you have here on the concentration of people in the Lower East Side. I mean, at one point, you know that while historians have talked a lot about the ethnic and class inflection to a lot of this anti-urban rhetoric, density, which was seen as the central problem of the cities, is enormous in the Lower East Side. 730.
Yeah.
People per acre.
Yeah.
In some places, 1,000 people per acre, and Chicago, it's 650, and on. And this is before high rises.
Right.
You know, these are places that have no streets, no water, no sanitation, no schools, lighting, transportation. It's staggering.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why, again, I want to resist the urge ever to think that there was a good old days here, because if you imagine what it would have smelled like. Chicago 100 years ago, right? You've got dead animals in the street. You've got dead animals floating in the river, right, from all the slaughterhouses. And there's no municipal sanitation system where it's just, right? So, in fact, government is the agency that makes all of that life better for people. And so it's housing on the one hand, it's sanitation on the other hand, it's sanitary markets over here, it's clean water over there. And all of this infrastructure is being built in the late 19th and really through the first quarter or even a little more of the 20th century, paved roads, gas lines, all that kind of stuff. That, it seems to me, is the great triumph of city life. And that's why a lot of progressives thought that the city would be the model for the rest of the nation, right? Mm-hmm. The problems of the city are simply the problems of the nation in microcosm. And so if we can solve them here, we can solve them nationally. And that's, I think, the reaction that prompts the reaction by these anti-government, anti-statist Americans who may or may not have, you know, ethno-racial bigotries, but they really object to the role of the state, because Americans are a nation of pioneers and homesteaders, and that's our mythology. And so they hate the idea that the city represents this cooperative, collective government enterprise.
Right, right. And these thinkers are, even worse, these thinkers are bringing in ideas from across the Atlantic. I mean, there's a lot of this cross-pollination, since mm-hmm. Europe is going through the same thing.
Yeah, I think that the, a number of really terrific historians, I'm thinking about Jim Kloppenburg and Dan Rogers, have looked at this transatlantic moment in progressive life. I think part of what's interesting to notice is what happens to those ideas on the boat as they come from Germany or England and they wind up in New York or Chicago. Things like zoning tend to get watered down. And I think that what Americans always want is the solution that will come somehow from the private sector. And so these ideas that get come on over, come over in a slightly different form. The biggest idea that I think an influential group of Americans brings up is the notion of the garden city, that the way to deal with the problem of the city is to decentralize it. That's the word that it just kept coming up every time I was doing my research. We're going to decentralize. We're going to move people out, and we're going to create new places for them to live. So that garden city idea pops up early in the 20th century. It pops up again in the 1930s. It pops up again in the 1960s and 70s. It's this, again, sort of undercurrent idea that we can solve the problem of the city by leaving it and by starting all over again, tabula rasa.
Right, right. Dispersing the population and the industry.
And the industry, exactly. And that's how to solve the problem, the problems of the city.
Right. I wonder if we could pause here just to talk a little bit about some of these people. You talk in this chapter about Dan Burnham and Jane Addams and Robert Park, some of these people that people might not be entirely familiar with listening right now.
Sure. So the progressives. So what I try to set up in this book is that this first couple of decades of the 20th century, what historians still refer to as the progressive era, is that moment in American life when a group of people want to commit to the city, want to make it work. And if in the 19th century the city had been seen as the problem, progressives see the city as a place with problems. And so what they become technocratic, they become pragmatic. What they want to identify is, okay, we have a problem of housing. How do we solve it? We have a problem of sanitation. How do we solve that? And that's really what progressive reforms are all about. If you look at the litany of progressive accomplishments, you notice that many of them are really designed to fix specific pieces of the urban problem. So Jane Addams, yes, but in Hull House, she's the person who recognizes, I think, some of the great possibilities of multiculturalism. She really isn't interested in simply melting these people down into a melting pot. She's recognizing that the Greeks and the Italians and the Poles each bring something interesting. Dan Burnham, the architect and city planner who was, you know, lived right across town from Jane Addams in Chicago, is thinking in terms of how we make cities, turn them into orderly and indeed sort of spectacular places. So the city has grown up in a haphazard way. It's been driven by private real estate interests, most of which have been bad. So the idea that we could use planning as a way of making something that is urban and making it urbane, I think that's what Burnham and other planners like him are all about. There are a couple of other of these progressives that pop up in my book. Frederick Ward Howe, who really believes that the key to that American democracy itself will be reinvigorated by urban life, precisely because it's where lots of different people have to come together to solve common problems. And that's the very definition of democracy as far as he's concerned. So, right, this nice collection of figures that I spend some time with in what I'm calling America's urban moment, this pivot between the 19th and the 20th century when Americans set about trying to really make cities work.
Yeah, and it really is a moment. When I was thinking about your book before calling you this morning, it actually really just struck me that these are just a few decades. It's 1920, and then with the census that America becomes a majority urban population, it was a long-standing trend. And as you say, we are still this quasi-urban nation. Yet, you know, to a significant degree, because of the things we just got done talking about, all these problems that density creates, and the lack of any sort of infrastructure and planning for it, and the difficulty of getting those things done, especially in the kind of system we have, right, where the states and the small towns are still the ones making these decisions. Right. So these cities are going through these problems, but they're not empowered to make those decisions to solve them.
You know, when you think about that period of spectacular urban growth, and let's date it, you know, approximately from the end of the Civil War through the, you know, 1920s. That is also the moment when lots of Western states are being added to the Union, carved out of those territories in the Trans-Mississippi West. So every one of those states has virtually nobody living in it, and they all get two senators. Right. And so by the time you get to Washington, you know, there are more people living in Chicago than probably Wyoming, Nevada, and Utah combined. And yet Chicago doesn't really have any representation in Washington. And you can play that out in microcosm at the state level as well.
Yeah, I'm editing one of the chapters from my book and talking about, you know, in the 1950s, right, just to give people a sense of the enormity of this, in the 1950s, you have Los Angeles, which is the fastest growing, right, one of the fastest growing cities in the post-war era. Los Angeles County has a tremendous number of people, I forget the number, and yet they had something like one or two congressmen. You know, and the same story could be said for New York. This is a big part of why Al Smith is important, and you know, the ways in which the state legislature, which benefits tremendously. I mean, all that corruption of Albany, you know, all these state legislators, I mean, they're cashing in on these cities that are the engines of economic growth. Right. Yet they, while they're content to build the city, they don't want to pay for any of the problems, or they don't want to.
Well, and again, it's not that they, and you know, there's all kinds of echoes here to contemporary politics, right? And that's part of what's fun about being a historian. But there are all kinds of, it's not that those people up there in upstate New York or in downstate Illinois object to government spending. We know that. We know that they love to cash those checks. They just don't want to see it. You know, I think the work of Brian Ballow down at UVA in his book on the 19th century talks about how Americans want their government hidden from them. So out there in the country, you ride out there on your interstate highways and you're cashing your agricultural subsidy checks and so on. And government is hidden from you. In the city, it's not. And I think that's what they really object to. It's public housing and public transportation and public schools. And so that's what gets people upset, is that it's somehow it's government out in front rather than behind the curtain.
Right. Okay. So let's go forward with the story here. So we're now up to the interwar period. And you talk about this you describe as a broad and somewhat inchoate movement of decentralists.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk a little bit about some of these characters? So there's Lewis Mumford and the Regional Planning Association, right. Ralph Bersody and these people.
Yeah. So what happens in the 20s, I think, is that, after the dust of the First World War settles, after immigration essentially ends, right, that with the war and then with the immigration restrictions, there's this moment when the anti-urbanists are able to collect themselves, catch their breaths, and then go to work, because the cities really, the dynamic of the cities has changed. Many of them fall in love with technology in the 1920s, and the two biggest pieces of technology they fall in love with are the automobile and electricity. Because those, the reason we're concentrated in cities is because that's the demand of the economy, right? It's where centralized power is. It's where resources get located, and therefore people have to be near those jobs. Okay, so that's the logic of the Industrial Revolution. For in the 1920s and even into the 30s, these folks begin to believe that the automobile can put us at a great distance from our jobs. We can move out that way. And electricity makes it possible to set up industries anywhere. You don't need to be near the river anymore or the source of the coal or anything else like that. Electricity, because it decentralizes the power necessary for industry. So some of these guys fall in love with that idea, that this is now the possibility, is we can use new technologies to achieve this decentralization. There are, you know, the Depression becomes this interesting moment when these decentralists have to come to terms with whether or not to use federal power, which they don't like, to achieve the goal of decentralization, which they do like. And I think one of the things I was really interested in, because I, you know, I didn't know this stuff very much before I started writing this book, was the extent to which the New Deal really was about trying to decentralize cities and industry. And so it's the Civilian Conservation Corps on the one hand, we're going to take these boys from the city, we're going to put them out in the country. And it's the Tennessee Valley Authority. We're going to electrify this entire backward rural region in order that, that Honda plants will now move down there and Mercedes plants and whatever else is down there nowadays, right? So these decentralists like Mumford, like Ralph Borsodi, who was a really crazy guy, really wacky, they have to sort of decide whether to get in bed with the New Deal or not, because the New Deal seems to be now the way in which we can use centralized power to achieve a decentralized nation. And that, I think, was a really interesting moment. There's also this thing in the Depression that I noticed, and Ralph Borsodi, who I think has, you know, largely been forgotten, was central to. There are a couple of these episodes in American life where, faced with a kind of national crisis, the American response is to go back to the land. And this did happen in the 30s. People did decide that my personal security would be better served if I went back to the farm. And so capitalizing on that, these homesteading projects, these resettlement projects, these new town projects, try to persuade people that there's a life to be had outside the city, which will protect you from the collapse of the economy. And I think you see that in the 30s, you see that at the end of the 60s. And how many of your neighbors there in New York are raising chickens right now? You know, I mean, the kind of impulse to do this, you know, and I think it is peculiarly American. We don't want to, you know, we want to go back to that 19th century. We get out our copy of Walden Pond and we decide that's where we're going to go to ride it all out. And I don't think that's a European tradition. I think Europeans tend to take to the streets and the Parisians throw up the barricades and we go back and start growing tomatoes. So that happens in the 1930s, this moment when maybe we can go back to the land, and that's the Depression will now drive us out of the cities to achieve that decentralized nation.
Yeah. We have this impression that the New Deal is focused on cities. We forget that, you know, FDR was a great hater in some ways of cities. Yeah. You know, I'm constantly struck by in thinking about the decline of the New Deal, you know, a big historiography, the ways in which the New Deal itself is responsible for the decline of the New Deal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, so you're quite right. Franklin Roosevelt did not like cities at all. And when you asked me a moment ago about, you know, are there figures who really did like American cities? I should have added FDR's cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, who really was a New York kid. and really did see the possibilities of urban life. He's rare. There's a wonderful line he writes about, you know, the what wonderful use the poet could make of the Bowery. You know, it's what would Dante do if he were here in Lower Manhattan? But anyway, yeah, the one of the very early biographies of Franklin Roosevelt is titled "Country Squire in the White House."
Right.
He was a country squire, and he thought we all ought to be too. So a number of the New Deal programs clearly had impacts in the city, but there was no urban policy as such, whereas much of his attention is really focused on both the agricultural economy, but also on rural life. And that's where, you know, as I said, you sort of tie together everything from the Agricultural Adjustment Act to the Civilian Conservation Corps, to the Tennessee Valley Authority. That's where the big projects are really happening. Get us out of the city.
Yeah, I was talking to Mason Williams a couple of weeks ago about his book on FDR and LaGuardia, and he was making this point that, you know, what FDR really wanted was were not these programs that the urban historians remember, but
that's right.
This back to the land stuff.
That's right. And so, you know, that in that sense, this is not a... I think it's worth remembering that the anti-urban tradition can cut in both directions on the political spectrum. You know, I think today we think of it as shaded far to the right, and I think that's largely true. But there is this left anti-urban tradition as well, and you can find it in the New Deal, and again, you find it in the 1960s.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get closer to the 60s and talk about the post-war era. In the post-war era, we see for the first time since people began counting that 11 of the 12 largest cities, these are cities in the north, all shrink.
Yep.
Two-thirds of the baby boom occurs in the suburbs.
Yep.
I did not know that. I found that a rather very important sociological fact. The big sort of showcase in your chapter here is urban renewal.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So here again, you know, maybe you can sort of hear the echo of the New Deal. Urban renewal is an idea that begins to percolate in the 30s. And the first piece of it is slum clearance. So the way we're finally going to solve the problem of concentration, density, and all that stuff, we're going to literally tear it all down. Urban renewal has been much written about, and I think it's hard to find too many defenders of urban renewal these days, because you look around at the results, and much of it is not pretty. The point that I wanted to make, I didn't want to pile on about that, but the point that I wanted to make here is that having finally now in the post-war period committed to a serious engagement with urban problems, the federal government really had no positive urban vision to draw on. So what they had to draw on was the suburbs. And so we were going to turn our cities into things that looked approximately like suburbs. And that's because there hasn't been a positively urban discourse in American life. So there was sort of urban renewal sort of doomed from the start, because once you tear it all down, what do you build in its place? And that's what nobody had any good ideas about that. So you have everybody from Le Corbusier, who comes to the United States in the 30s, and so, you know, and the Radiant City model, and you have Futurama from the 1939 World's Fair. Big highways, big towers. Well, that's what American cities were turned into after the Second World War. It looks a lot like Futurama. So that's really the point that I wanted to make about urban renewal. And in terms of that you were just describing, when it's clear that the situation of the American city is deteriorating in the 1960s, it's a combination of economics and racial tension and all that sort of stuff that historians like Tom Segrew have detailed, I would see the beginning of the end of America's liberal consensus beginning in the city. If it's the failure of the city that both sides, right and left, point to as what's bankrupt about the liberal agenda.
Right. It's sort of surprising to me. I like that you, it's logical to follow up the talk of urban renewal with talking about the highway, but I like that you point out that while urban renewal displaced, what, 600,000 people, the Highway Act, unlike urban renewal, which becomes a symbol for liberal failure, the failure of the federal government to do things and provokes this act on the left and the right, the Highway Act, which is this phenomenally larger use of government power, it displaces millions of people, it's this complete handout, this corporate handout, and yet there is no anti-government response.
right.
The highway, by the early 1960s, you've got what, Robert Weaver or Charles Abrams, I forget who, admitting publicly that urban renewal has been terrible.
Right.
It's become Negro removal,
right,
even though a third of the people displaced are white. And but late into the 60s, people are celebrating the destruction of
That's
highways.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the interesting things that I simply didn't know before I started poking around, was that just how little opposition there was to the highway until really the end of the 1960s and then into the 1970s, that even while urban renewal projects were being condemned, highway projects rolled on. And part of this, I think, go back to your question or your comment about structure. I think if you follow the money, it helps explain this a little bit, because urban renewal was federal money that was then administered locally in whatever city was going to do the project. So
right,
it was through an agency established by city government, et cetera, which meant that if you didn't like it, you could walk down to City Hall and you knew who you could beat up. The highway projects sent money to the state, to state capitals, and it was the State Department of Transportation's, which then planned out all those roads, executed the contracts, and did the construction, which meant that if you were in New York, you'd have to go to Albany.
Right.
And nobody, so the buck never really stopped anywhere, right? For these,
exactly.
So it's hard to know where you would have gone to protest. But I think
I taught at four colleges in New York, and I would wager that a good number of the students didn't know that Albany was the capital, right?
Right, exactly. Much was where it was, yeah. But it is also the case, right, that the highway is that great example of hidden government, because it gets funded at the tune of 90 cents to every dollar by the federal government. But everybody who drives on it thinks it's their road, and that they own it private. And so I think that also helps explain why these highway projects were relatively uncontroversial. And what I mean by that as well is that the urban renewal legislation also insisted on dealing with displacement. So we know how many people were displaced by urban renewal projects, approximately. The highway legislation didn't do anything like that. You didn't have to count how many people you were displacing. You didn't have to do anything for them once you displaced them, once you bought them out and tore down the buildings. So in fact, we really don't know in real exact terms what the consequences of the highway projects really were.
Yeah, maybe that's an important thing to note. I mean, there's this impression too that this had to be inevitable, but there's both things at work too, right? I mean, the design of the program pushes this anti-urban agenda, right?
Right.
I mean, so Kenneth Jackson, in his book on the suburbs, talks about how the FHA made it cheaper to have a house in the suburbs than to have an apartment in the city.
Right.
These highways, the second that there's a plan announced, this was news to me that the local real estate market just nosedives.
Oh, sure.
So this is encouraging people to, 70%, your quote, another staggering quote from your book, 70% of the public is relying on public transportation in the mid-1950s.
Yeah, to get to work. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the federal government is driving, essentially, you have this, I forget who it was that you quote, but you know, it's almost as if there's a conspiracy, you know, this Washington conspiracy against the city.
Right. Yeah. And so in that sense, if we really do believe all the Chicago school economists that we're just rational actors responding to incentives, the incentives are all to move to the suburbs. You can do it on a federally subsidized road with federally subsidized gasoline, go to your federally subsidized house, and it is much cheaper and easier than renting an apartment in a city, which is now deteriorating in large swaths of urban America, right? That the deindustrialization that's happening at the same time, sort of nobody really quite recognizes the tsunami that that's going to create. So, yeah, no, I wouldn't say conspiracy. I just because it gives people far too much credit. but it's right. It's this kind of confluence of incentives that get created. And right, the number of people who are employed in the economy by the early 1970s in things that have to do with cars. So it's whether it's in the auto industry, the highway construction industry, the auto parts. And I mean, it's just a staggering number, the extent to which the economy is dependent now on everything that has to do with automobiles by the end of this period.
Yeah. And I didn't know this as well that I know a little bit about this because I'm writing a biography of Danny Patrick Moynihan, who had a big article on the Highway Act and some of this stuff. And you note that in 1962, Congress added language to the Highway Act, I guess, right, forcing some of these states to provide relocation assistance, which was common to a lot of programs in Europe. And, but the states ignored the mandate and then falsified reports to Washington claiming that there was plenty of available housing around.
Right.
Because when they put down these highways, they would either, you know, just demolish the neighborhood. They would cut it off from the rest of the neighborhood, you know, and so that they can get this federal money.
Yeah, that's right. And as well, I think it's a Yale Law Review article I found from either the late 60s or the early 70s. Which tried to survey how many lawsuits had been filed against highway projects. And it's a tiny number. Whereas, again, urban renewal projects by this point have become very controversial, turns people out in the streets, they're fighting in the courts and so on and so forth. But it really, I think I say in the book, as much as fleets of bulldozers can fly under the radar screen, this really somehow flew under the radar screen for a lot of Americans. Because, again, I think it was really perceived as something. This is where America's headed. Trains are the old news and cars are the wave of the future. And so these road projects just they just went ahead.
And of course, and this is, you know, in the 1960s, race becomes the dominant factor in these conversations, because you have all these people that, again, you know, Southerners using New Deal loan money are automating in the South and pushing millions of, you know, 3 million blacks and millions more whites out of the South, and they're coming north to these cities where jobs are leaving, and then they're then being stranded there. These calls by Walter Reuther and Roy Wilkins and everyone else to have Marshall plans for the cities fall on deaf ears, because the cities are the place of riots and they're in the place of, you know, there are places people want to leave.
Yeah. So I think again that a lot of people have looked at the racial dynamics of that urban crisis moment in the 50s and certainly in the 1960s. And the way I massage this a little bit in my book is to suggest that the 1960s is the moment when these two strands of anti-urbanism that I've been documenting come together. So it's the ethno-racial bigotries on the one hand and the government on the other hand. Now they're the same thing. Right. Because it's the government is working for those people and those public housing projects. It's my tax money for those people. And that, I think, is right. That kind of perfect storm of bad circumstances that really do cause this sense that we just got to get rid of the cities altogether.
And to your point earlier, I mean, when the Kerner report comes out, there's 20 pages, right?
Yeah.
up to planning for the city.
Yeah.
So there's no intellectual
That's right.
fodder
That's right.
for thinking forward. Pruitt Igoe's blown up and it's the end of an era. And
Yeah, and the Nixon administration really does now, you know, the Nixon administration plus the recession of the 70s, but that's really the end of federal urban policy. And we really haven't had anything equivalent since. And maybe that's a good thing given the results. But it's kind of interesting to think about that in 40 odd years, urban policy has taken place almost entirely at the local level. Right, it's community groups and CDCs and urban homesteaders and things like this. There's been no larger sense of how you recreate the structure of incentives to promote a healthier urbanism, right? Because we're still subsidizing the suburbs, we're still subsidizing private automobile use, et cetera, and that's been, you know, as I said, we've been sort of absent in urban policy for 40 years now.
And well, this leads perfectly to the end of the book, which is talking about the rise of the Sun Belt cities,
Yes.
Houston and these other places, which embody the views and the values of these decentralists, right?
Yeah.
And
So,
come to dominate not just in terms of the size, large cities in America, but also politically.
yeah. So the Sun Belt cities that really, and they, I think people at the time, you know, after the Second World War, were genuinely astonished. It really was like they just came out of nowhere, like mushrooms after a rainstorm in the forest. But here's the place where you don't have to rebuild along these decentralist principles. You can just build from scratch because these places are so small to begin with. And so what I was really struck by were the figures about density, that these places are so thinly populated as compared to the older industrial cities. So that sense you have in Los Angeles or Houston or Phoenix or Dallas, that it's all horizontal, I mean, that's numerically true, that the population is spread out. So, you know, the density of Chicago is, I'm gonna get this mostly right, is something like 12,000 people per square mile, and in Dallas it's something like 3,000 people per square mile. So that idea that it's all gonna be built around the cars, it's all gonna be built horizontally. And in that way as well, we can solve the problem of ethno-racial heterogeneity because we'll never interact with people. We'll spread ourselves so far apart that there are no sidewalks that we can bump up into each other on. We'll all be in our cars and we'll all be spread all over this vast area. And I think it's not coincidental that these are the places. So just as the city in the north is the place where the liberal agenda falls apart, the city in the south is where the new right agenda coalesces. And my, you know, I had fun writing about Houston because Houston remains the largest city in the United States without a zoning code. And the reason it doesn't have a zoning code is because zoning, if you impose land use restrictions, that's the first step to Stalinism. I mean, that's what these people really believe, and they believe that.
You're right that John, founder, Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society, comes to give talks on this point.
Yeah,
It's just
exactly.
astounding to me.
Right. So it's the slippery slope, right? So we're going to keep government entirely out of the business of building the city altogether, which is why those places become such a mess. I mean, one of the things I probably could have written a little more about is that this is the attitude that dominates in Houston in the 50s and 60s during this incredible boom period. By the 70s and 80s, they've quietly walked some of this back.
Yeah.
In fact, our city is a mess. Air pollution, the crime, and so maybe we do actually have to start accepting some federal help here because what we got is not working. But they, as I say, they do that very quietly. They don't want to admit too much out loud. And Houston itself, of course, has changed demographically. So talking about Houston at the end of the 20th century is a very different place. But nonetheless, I had fun writing about that.
Yeah, I wanted more on that, but next book maybe.
Right.
So okay, so this is now the end of the era, and we get to we have the hippies, the commune movement,
yeah.
We have the 1980s and the communitarians and the new urbanists. So maybe you can
try to pull all those together. Yeah, so I think what, you know, just like in the 1930s, there is this anti-urban left that emerges in the 1960s, and I see it, I focused on it most in this back to the land commune movement, which was a very big deal, even if it was only briefly a very big deal, probably about a decade from the end of the 60s to the end of the 70s. And what you see there is the same kind of rhetoric that you see from a different part of the political spectrum. The city is the source of all of our problems. And if we're going to and it's oppressive and it's the establishment and it's all this other sort of stuff. It's what gave us the Vietnam War and et cetera, et cetera. So the solution is to go back and go back to the land and get a pair of overalls and start growing organic vegetables. And I lived on one of those places on and off for a while. And so I totally understand the appeal of it. But it is part of that anti-urban tradition. By the end of the century, and then in that last part of the book, I pair up the new urbanist planners, architects, and advocates with this little movement in sociology and philosophy called communitarianism, and the people associated with that are people like Emitai Azioni and who's at GW, I think, and Robert Putnam, the sociologist at Harvard, that what we need to do is restore some sense of community values, because we've become atomized individuals. We all go bowling alone, and therefore we need to rebuild our society to promote community values. But what's fascinating to me about them, or why I wanted to write about them, was that they cannot envision that community can be created in an urban context. So when they think about where this is going to take place, it's almost inevitably the suburbs. So you see the same kind of anti-urban bias, even at the end of the 20th century, that we can't have those meaningful bonds, social relationships, shared obligations, except out there in the suburb or maybe in a small town. You can't have it in Brooklyn or on the west side of Chicago. And I just think that you know, in some ways it almost parrots what people were saying at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah. It's very flattering to you as a person if you're living in the suburbs. But almost from the beginning, there are people in the suburbs who are complaining about how stultifying life is there.
That's right.
You know, I mean, the suburbs are. You have this. Right at one point, there's almost an invisible umbilical cord tying these suburbs to the cities. They depend on these
That's
cities,
right.
not just for their jobs,
right,
and the economic growth that they produce, but also because cities are, as we said in the beginning, right, these enormous producers of cultural life.
That's right. Yeah, it's not an accident that the majority of the great American universities are located in the middle of cities. That's, you know, in England, it's Oxford and Cambridge, and they're out sort of and that's the monastic model. But here it's the University of Chicago and it's Harvard and it's UCLA and the University of Minnesota, and they're all located in urban centers. And that's, as I said, it's not coincidental. So when you want your medical research done, when you want to listen to the symphony orchestra, when you're looking for where new art, new ideas come from, they're not going to come, from Hicksville, Long Island. They're coming from urban centers, right? So both economically, but in all these other ways, we are umbilically connected. William White writes about this in the 1950s. He may be the first person to see that the suburbs are producing this alienation. And the way he describes it in The Organization Man is your heart and your treasure are in two different places. You live in the suburb, but you work in the city, so you really aren't part of either place. And that creates this atomized, alienated person. And I think he came out with that book in about 1956. And I think I think there's still some truth to that.
Yeah. Well, we've taken a lot of your time today. I'm very glad to have had the chance to speak to you. This is a wonderful book. I hope everyone goes out and buys it. Why don't you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, wow, what a good question. And first, thanks for so much for having me. So at the moment, I'm working on a very small article that takes me back to the 19th century, and doesn't have anything much to do at all with cities, but has to do with the anti-Catholic sentiment in the 1840s and 50s. And I'm interested in how it was connected to Americans' ideas or views of the Italian Revolution in 1848, 1849. This is a project that came out of an undergraduate class I taught a couple of years ago, and I just thought, well, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to go pursue this for a while and see what happens to it. So that's what's on the docket at the moment.
Okay, well, that sounds really interesting. Well, Steve, thanks so much for talking to
Thank
us today.
you.